Hi, and welcome to our first virtual coffee in a live stream format. My name is Gavin O'Mara. I'm the CEO and founder of FE News. And today, we've got a real special guest of David Gallagher from NCFE, who's going to be joining me. I've been a little bit purposeful around choosing David for our first live stream. There's a couple of reasons. NCFE are a really interesting company. Not many people know. I'm going to check the dates on this. But NCFE were established in 1848. That's 173 years of being supporting the sector. That's a really long time. So I'll be really keen to find out a little bit more detail around what they're doing for the future and a little bit about the past as well. But 173 years, that's a really long time. NCFE, they're a social impact organisation. You know, they're a awarding organisation. Many people know about that. The many different elements which they support the sector as a part of the ecosystem. But they've also got their own independent think tank, a real independent think tank, and how cool is that? They're also working with World Skills UK to help project excellence in the UK for the skills system globally. And also for David, so many times I've heard from people to say you need to hear David's vision for the future of education and skills. So it's been an absolute pleasure to have a coffee with David Gallagher. And David, I'd love to welcome you to our first live stream virtual coffee. How are you?
Yeah, really good, Gavin, and what an intro. Thank you for that. I hope I can live up to it, especially given the fact that we're live. But no, it's a real honour to be here in this new format. And yeah, I'm really good, really good. How are you?
Yeah, cool stuff. Yeah, I'm really good. I'm really, to be honest, I've been really excited to do this one because there's so many different things I wanted to cover with you. I mean, for everyone, this is going to be mainly around the future of education, the future of skills, the future of qualifications, and the future of work. But David, I wanted to kick this off around mental health and well-being. We've gone through a crazy 18 months of just absolute mayhem, and everyone's sort of really, everyone's had a real suffering with either physical or mental health around that. But NCFE and a part of the NCFE family seem to have really focused heavily on mental health and well-being support over the past, to me, the last sort of 18 months. Can we sort of unpack that a bit? Because I think that's really interesting the way that you've sort of gone down that route, really.
Yeah, of course. And this is something that I care about a lot, actually. And it's really, this is one of the big silver linings to the, the pandemic over the last 18 months for me, that it feels like in the public consciousness, there's a greater sense of, how important mental health, mental fitness is, and a recognition that everyone can be affected in different ways at different times, and suffer as a result of mental health challenges. And that there seems to be a stronger sense of wanting to do something really proactive and more often than not now preventative as well to make sure people are fit and strong. So we going back to pre-pandemic, because we're involved in designing and developing qualifications in education, childcare, early years, health, social care, mental health and physical health have always been things that were really interesting to us. But then as the pandemic hit, we spent a lot of time talking to our customers, talking to our workforce, talking to stakeholders. And it was really apparent that the phrase that I think describes it best for me is that we're not necessarily all in the same boat, but we were very definitely all in the same storm. And some of us clinging onto a life raft, some of us in luxury liners, but that storm really battering all of us in lots of different ways. I reflected on my own situations, really, really, really incredibly fortunate in so many ways and have so many sort of advantages because of, my role and, my family situation and what have you. But there was times where I even knew for myself I was struggling. I've got two young boys and there was homeschooling. I had parents sheltering, not having the social connections. And so, feeling that myself, and I remember thinking actually, if this is really impacting me and my mental health and well-being, bloody hell, how's that impacting on other people that don't have, the very, very fortunate situation that I've got. I was really fortunate about the same time to speak to an organisation called FICA as well, and a guy called Nick Gareth who founded FICA. And it was quite a profound first meeting that I had with Nick, where Nick talked about the fact that in this country, we've got a bit of a deficit culture around mental health. So we typically wait till there's a crisis, then we intervene. But even then, we all know that services are under-resourced to deal with a mental health crisis. And this was pre-pandemic. And what Nick said to me is, he said, well, actually, we should think about mental health as a fitness, and a fitness that can be worked on continuously. And this, I remember in a previous session talking about, well, look, the pandemic was the equivalent of us just being asked to get up out of bed one day and go and run a marathon without any training for a marathon, because we hadn't been necessarily working on our mental fitness and our mental strength to be able to run the marathon that was dealing with the pandemic and everything that it threw at us. And that was a light bulb moment for me, because I thought about, okay, so if we've got a deficit culture and we look at, you know, first aid, for example, which is hugely important, but first aid gets administered when something's gone wrong. Could we think about proactive and preventative fitness? And Nick and Gareth and then other organisations, other people, really highlighted to me that this is something that we can do proactively to continuously build our fitness to deal with whatever the world throws at us. So, I mean, we've done all sorts, as you say, but it's something that if you haven't got mental fitness, if you haven't got mental strength, resilience, resourcefulness, all of these things, you're not going to be equipped to learn, never mind grow and develop.
Yeah.
And so these are, you know, it's one of the things that I think is crucial to underpinning great educational experiences, great career experiences, great life experiences, and the best possible outcomes, you know, for you and your family. So that's why it's, I'm off on one with this already.
This is important, isn't it? And I think this sort of really sort of rolls into what I want to do next, because I think what's interesting is you guys have, we've got this overview of, like, you know, employability, skills, you know, the future of work. And I just, you know, and I think what's underpinning within that is we've got to look after ourselves to be able to do any of those things, haven't we, at the end of the day. Can we talk about the future of work? Because the pandemic has sped all of these sort of things up. So, like, fourth industrial revolution, what is the future of work? And it'd be sort of interesting to sort of see what your take is on that, really.
Yeah, so I'll pick up on a couple of threads around employability, first of all, if that's all right. So really early on in my career, I was massively fortunate to fall into welfare to work or employability. So government-funded contracts to support people from typically really disadvantaged backgrounds to help them to get into work. And then as the industry evolved over the time I was in it, it started to be more about sustainable work. Which was, you know, a step in the right direction. But if I think about employability, that word in itself is an issue for me, and I'll explain why. Because just the other side of employability is unemployable. So is the focus to get people to just the other side of unemployable? And I don't believe that anybody is unemployable. Do you know that the people might need the right opportunity, the means, the motivation, the conditions, you know, a role shaped around their particular needs. But everybody, I believe, has got the potential to not just be employable, but to find meaningful and fulfilling work. So I think sometimes the label we put on these things is not aspirational enough. And in some ways, it's almost that I think it can be quite offensive to the people concerned. But I think about that, about other things as well, like competence. So what's just the other side of competence? It's incompetence. And so what, we want to train people to be just better than incompetent. It's not good enough. You know, we should be thinking about excellence and it being available for everybody. So I mean, there's some of the things I think about initially about that whole, what we label employability, which I don't think is the right label. But in terms of the future of work, I mean, to some extent, some elements of this are unpredictable, but other elements are predictable. You know, if you look at, as you say, what's happening around in Industry 4.0, automation, AI, you know, different trends in the world. And there are a couple of things that I believe to be absolutely true for the midterm, possibly the long term. The vast majority of people going into work will have multiple occupations over a career and may even have multiple occupations at the same time. You know, that we see lots of people having a number of different jobs, particularly in what, you know, has been described as the gig economy in recent years. Yeah. So the reason I mention that in particular is that we've got to move beyond the notion that it is appropriate for formal, regulated, government-funded education to produce somebody with the skills to work in one occupation. Because I believe education should be there to set you up for a lifetime. And whilst, you know, you can't be taught every technical skill, you know, we're not quite in the Matrix yet where you can just some, you know, kung fu. But we actually, in reality, you know, we have to give people the underpinning skills, character traits that will enable them to adapt for a very dynamically changing labour market, because people are going to have, for the most part, multiple occupations over a career and over a lifetime. And just think about the fact that, you know, our working life is continuously being extended as well. So you've got, up until recent years, we had two generations in the workforce. We then had three. We've now got four generations all in the workforce. Yep. And, you know, we're talking about paying off the pandemic debt, that working life might be extended even further, which is a worrying situation. But with that being the case, how do we give people the skills to adapt, to change, to work in diverse, multi-generational workforces, you know, to find meaningful work? And so I think that for me is, you know, really important that we think about that quite deeply and try and move beyond this notion that, particularly in vocational and technical education, but also in some academic settings as well, in higher education, degrees, master's, doctorates, that we just channel people into one occupation because it doesn't necessarily serve them well. So yep. With the long term. So that's, I suppose, the first point. The second point that I'll make on this is that we've operated in a knowledge economy, you know, a really successful, in this country in particular, and others around the world, a really productive knowledge economy. And that's important, and we shouldn't lose that. But we've got to move beyond that to think about, well, not just that we know things, that we're able to apply them, and we know how to do things as well, you know, very practical. So I'm talking technical skills, I'm talking vocational skills, I'm talking applied knowledge. And so we've got to move beyond the knowledge economy and not lose what's good about the knowledge economy, but think about a skills economy. And within that, I also think we've then got to take it further and not just think about technical and vocational, but think about the deeply human skills that the robots, in inverted commas, are not going to be best placed to deliver.
100%.
Yeah, a good, great example of this. So this is it's a little bit of an old example now, but it was about 2 years ago that for the first time ever, artificial intelligence became better at identifying cells that were likely to be cancerous through mammographs. So looking at the screens and looking at mammographs and seeing, right, that this is a cancerous cell, this is a cancerous cell. And so because the artificial intelligence has become better at that, doctors don't need to do that because the AI can do it. So somebody in a session I was in said to me, does that mean we'll need less doctors? And the response, which I thought was brilliant, it was like, absolutely not. We can get doctors focused on prevention, the caring side of things, you know, offering that real human connection with people, helping them to cope with what's going on. And hopefully, you know, research and the science that's required to prevent people getting breast cancer. And I thought that was phenomenal. We don't need less doctors. We just need doctors with different skill sets and different leanings that still have, you know, some of the technical understanding. So that was one. And then there was another one. This is, we joked with our commercial guy at NCFE, actually, who looks at lots of legal contracts, that in future he could well be a robot. Because there was an example of where artificial intelligence was out-competing the best lawyers in terms of reading contracts and finding where there were issues and challenges and suggesting fixes for them. And the interesting thing, and this fits perfectly, actually, is the best humans, I think, were taking half an hour to do this piece of work and were drinking two cups of coffee. The robots learn how to do it in seconds. And that's, you know, that's maybe a threat in terms of, you know, does that mean that jobs disappear, or does it mean that actually the people in those roles at the moment need to reskill and retool? So this is, for me, these are the sorts of things that we've got to think about. What are the new occupations? What are the occupations that change dramatically? And what are the deep human and meta skills that the robots are never likely to be great at, that we've got to be able to work effectively in harmony with, you know, where the world's going. So creativity, problem solving, empathy, you know, there's such a wide range of things. So they're the sorts of things that I tend to think about.
That's really, really cool. I had a term sort of thrown at me, it seems like a different world pre-pandemic, doesn't it? Which was sort of about cobots, about how we, you know, we can work with different, and, you know, automation. So, like, you know, AI in particular, but also in different sort of physical settings with bots as well. And I thought that was quite an interesting concept of skill and developing it. So I love it that the way you're sort of, you know, going down that route, really. We've also, we're talking about AI and we're talking about future stuff. I'd love to talk to you about your sort of vision for the future of qualifications, because we've had all these different qualification reviews, but they've been about looking at the future. But how future is that? You know, because the world's sped up quite a bit. So I'm thinking sort of, let's go horizon, you know, and see. I know you've got a lot of views around currency of qualifications and store of value. And if we go down that route, anyone who knows anything about this will be thinking around, you know, blockchain or NFTs and things like that. What could the future mean? I'd love to hear your views on that.
Yeah, okay. So there's three things that jump to mind on that, actually. So I'll start with two and then come back to the, you know, this globally recognized store of value, if that's okay, Gavin. So one of the things that I suppose horrifies me about formal education at the moment, and this was, I can't remember the specific research, but there was some stat came out recently that suggested that educators, and it was a very generic, very broad brush statement, but educators spend about 60% of their time planning and marking. So that really made me stop and think, actually, that planning and marking is hugely, hugely important, but it's quite transactional. It's very burdensome. It's bureaucratic. And you know, you've got to plan great sessions to deliver great teaching and learning. I do understand that. But for 60% of the time to be taken on these almost administrative tasks, yep, that only leaves at very best 40% of time to focus on engaging, enthusing, inspiring, helping people to be creative, truly personalizing learning experiences, to do the wide range of things that many of our educators have to do now that they maybe wouldn't have had to do previously. Do you know, the pastoral element, the empathetic element, the working on mental health and fitness. Being an educator is such a challenging job. It's such a difficult job in all settings, actually, primary, secondary, tertiary, colleges, you know, universities, adult learning, because it's an incredibly difficult set of skills and tools and techniques and experiences that you draw on to deliver fantastic teaching and learning. Do you know, ask anyone that's done homeschooling, do you know, to realize it's really hard. Yeah. I lead an educational charity, and this job looks easy compared to homeschooling. And I mean that literally. So then you only have 40% of the time to do the things that are really adding the most possible value. It's not good enough. And when I speak to educators, it's incredible that the vast majority of them that I've ever spoken to come into education because they want to make a difference. They want to enthuse. They want to inspire. They care deeply for their students of whatever age. They want them to get the best outcomes and, you know, have the best opportunities in life. But they spend 60% of the time doing compliance stuff, you know, admin stuff. So that's the first thing. How do we find really efficient and effective? How do we leverage technology to free up as much time as possible? Because we can't necessarily, you know, keep pouring more money in. We definitely should put more money in, but that's not an endless pot. It's finite. Therefore, how do we get really smart in terms of, even if we took 10% of that away, you know, 10% more time for an educator to focus on what matters most, which is a deep understanding of their learners, a deep connection with their learners, and an ability to inspire them, infuse them, and develop these human skills that won't matter so much. So that's the first thing that I think we get wrong. And the second thing that I'll talk about, and this is a quite a different angle on it, and I'll simplify it to sort of make the point, apprenticeship standards. So the standards that we've got for apprenticeships now, on average, have taken about 2 years to develop. So from start to finish, we've got an idea for a standard, and it has sped up over time, but the average, when I've looked at this, and it my experience is slightly out of date, but it's not so out of date, is about 2 years. It then takes about a year for the market to adopt that standard and start delivering it to students. And as a minimum, it then takes another year, but might take 3 or 4, before the first apprentice pops up in the workforce, knowledgeable, skilled, and productive in using that skill. And even then, they might be honing the skill. So from start to finish, best case scenario, that's 4 years. How many occupations, how many sectors stand still over a 4-year period?
Yeah, particularly now, right, with what's happened with the pandemic.
Yeah, do you know what? And I mentioned recently, well, maybe dry stone walling might stand still for that long. You know, funny enough, it actually doesn't. It actually doesn't, because of tools and techniques and technology. Do you know how GPS works? You know, and so even what I've sort of described as the biblical trades, even they move on over a four-year period typically. So how is that good enough? How is that giving us the underpinnings to have a really high quality system? So we've got to be faster and better in terms of the design, the development of standards and qualifications. We should be able to do that much more rapidly. We should have a more a stronger democratized approach to that, where more stakeholders have their say, educators, people who've done these programs previously, you know, the alumni of these programs, people employed in those occupations, people who employ people in those occupations, other sector bodies and stakeholders. So we should democratize the design of these things, but do it much, much faster. And we've got some ideas about how that can happen, because otherwise it's just never going to keep pace with reality. So that, yes, that's a bit of a problem. But also then, is if we do get faster and better at doing that, how do we then equip the educators to deliver that? Do you know, if they've been out of industry for a couple of years and they
understand.
So we've got to find smarter ways of getting educators and education institutions to the heart of industry, to the heart of employers, to best understand them, to bring that back and deliver it. So that's one other element that I think is hugely important. And then to answer this final point around the currency of qualifications, as in, you know, how we think about fiat currency, you know, pounds, dollars, etc. The currency of qualifications, I find it quite baffling, actually, that we talked about this a while back, didn't we, Gavin? Do you know, when we were kids first in the workforce, you go and do your weekend job, and the next Friday you get your physical pay packet in your hand with your pay slip. And I remember ripping it open and looking at that real money and having an overwhelming sense of satisfaction and pride, and, you know, knowing that I could go out and have some fun with it as well, because I knew that I'd put the work in and that was the currency that I'd got, and I knew what it could get me, you know, some new clothes, some new trainers, a night out, you know, save up for a holiday, whatever it might be. And there was that overwhelming sense of satisfaction. Now, the reason I mention that is because actually the paper-based certificates that we offer for qualifications today, I still think have the potential to have that impact. You know, people get the certificate through the door, show mum and dad, put it on the wall, you know, laminate it, whatever, you know, frame it, and it can have that impact. But it doesn't have as strong an impact as it could and should, because I think quite often it's quite confusing as to what that thing is actually worth. It's a bit of paper, but we don't understand its value. Do you know, if you've got £20, if I've got £20, if I pop down to Morrison's or Sainsbury's or Asda or wherever, or Aldi, I actually quite like shopping in Aldi now as well. do you know, I get a lot more for my £20 when I'm there. Do you know, if we've got £20, we roughly, most of us, other than those that are detached from reality, we know what it can get us. But with our paper-based certificate, we don't always know, and that's not right. Do you know, people have invested their time and sometimes their money, which, I mean, their time is their most important asset, I suppose, invested in achieving this. If they don't know what that's worth, that's a problem. If the people who are going to then recognise their currency, which in our world, because we do vocational and technical, if that employer doesn't recognise the value, that's a problem. So that's the sort of first part of that. Then the second part of this, where this problem, I think, becomes even more profound, is if you take that currency overseas, if you take it, you know, to a different employer sometimes, yep, a different sector, people don't even recognise that it's currency. Do you know, it's like turning up with monopoly money sometimes, you know, to spend in a different country. People just don't recognize it. And that's wrong. It's wrong. So for me, we've got to think, how do we make sure that the paper-based currency that we have, which I still think has a role, is really understood? But then how do we think about a digital form of currency that is globally recognized, that enables, yeah, people to take it wherever they want to go with it, you know, wherever they can find opportunities that are right for them, wherever that is in the world, wherever that is in the labour market, that they've got something that has got a deep, well-understood store of value. And I think digital approaches, whether that's crypto or whether that's NFT, that I think has to be the way to go. So how do we have the paper currency that means something, but also probably a digital,
yep,
globally recognized store of value that enables people to use that as true currency to get to where they want to get to in life? And for me, that is we've got to go a long way within our qualification system to get to that, but that's something that we're massively interested in.
It's exciting, though, isn't it? We're in this sort of really interesting time when it's now an established industry, isn't it? You know, and it's like the whole sort of blockchain sort of area. There's some weird bits to it, but there is with everything, you know, and it's just like, how do you then sort of move that forward? And like you're saying, it's value, and people are understanding the brand value of what a level X or what a Y is, isn't it? So as they can then transfer that to say to their mum and dad, I've got an X, and I don't know what that is. And it's to try to avoid that, isn't it? Or to an employer, I ain't got a clue what a, you know, what an XYZ is. And I think we're going through that as an education system at the moment, aren't we? We've like, you know, we've had a lot of change, like T levels and stuff like that. People still know what that is properly. I think there's a lot of sort of growth around sort of awareness in that. But I think if we go again, it's to make sure this is like a foundation step to move and to really grow for people, isn't it? I think it's a really interesting time at the minute.
Yeah.
We're nearly out of time, and I don't want to be. So if everyone's all right, I want to continue because this is really cool. I've got we've had the which is really good to look at, actually, and to sort of see it sort of grow, was the College of the Future. And it then not only did it look at England, but it looked around the four nations, which I think is key. Do you know what I mean? I think is key, because we can learn a lot from just working together much more. That was cool to look at college, but we've got an ecosystem in the sector. Things have moved on a bit. Do you know what I mean? What would you say if you could like sort of have a dream of this sort of country, what would you say the ecosystem of the system of the future to be for education and skills? I won't say the word employability, but to help people just grow in whatever they want to do. Because it's like you said, it's a really weird term, like social mobility. Yeah. It's a weird word where people, you know, sort of expect, it's a bit middle class, we expect, well, they got to move out of that area. Well, they don't want it. They've got all sorts of different community within that they want to move out. So it's like, what would you see sort of the ecosystem of the future to be?
It's a really good question, Gavin, and I'll try not to talk about this one for too long with us not having too much time left. But I think thinking about it as an ecosystem is really important. And I use some parallels on this. So if you look into the likes of a Google or an Apple and whatever you think of them, whilst you may have this really coherent brand over the top of, you know, the products and services that they offer, what you actually find when you get underneath it is an ecosystem of businesses that work symbiotically. So do you know what? I mean, they're quite aggressive in terms of acquisitions and what have you, but there is lots of different moving parts to these hugely successful organizations that essentially under this roof, they have an ecosystem of businesses, functions, capabilities that work interdependently. They quite often work symbiotically to create, you know, the new and innovative and leading edge ways of doing things. And so that's something that I don't think is well understood in different sectors and different industries. And I am a little bit worried in tertiary education that we're going down the route of establishing really monolithic, big centralized organizations and powers that just do everything. And, you know, whilst that, you know, may give us coherence, is it really going to give us, you know, the rich diversity of experiences, perspectives, you know, goals and objectives, that sort of competitive and collaborative spirit that is, you know, that creative space to think differently and better as to how, and continuously think differently and better as to how we give people the best educational experiences and to get them the best outcomes. So I think that recognition that an ecosystem approach is absolutely right, because in other industries, that's how organizations are successful. And almost across the board, you know, show me the true monoliths that are fit for purpose for how the world is now. And I think you might see a monolithic brand, but underneath it, it's very, very different. So and so within that, then I think the real key to success here, it is about it's moving to thinking smartly about we share our collective intelligence and our collective resources. And I know I really do bang on about this, but the World Skills Centre of Excellence is a great example. We had a belief that educators needed investing in to get to a standard of excellence if we wanted excellent experiences and outcomes. World Skills were better placed than us to do it, so we invested in World Skills. You know, we made a decision to invest in them, and we there were some commercial considerations, but actually just fundamentally it was the right thing to do because of what we believe and what the evidence was telling us. So a real example of collective resources, collective intelligence, mostly their intelligence, not mine, but to think about how do we act in this ecosystem to make it better for learners. So for me, collective resource, collective intelligence, true collaborative spirit, really deeply connecting around what is the purpose of this thing that we're doing and where is it that we're trying to get to. And if you've got a shared sense of purpose as a sector, as an industry, and you've got broad consensus in terms of where you want to ultimately get to, you know, let there be, you know, a million different paths to get there, but knowing that we're all heading in the same direction. And what I'm really heartened by, actually, whilst I'm worried about this move towards some monolithic centralization of power, what I'm really heartened by is the grassroots. More organizations than I've ever seen in my nearly 20 years in this sector are really, truly, deeply collaborating for the benefit of learners. And if we can just stay true to that, we'll do all right. You know, we'll do all right.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's just not losing sight of what it's all about, isn't it, at the end of the day? Yeah. It's sort of, yeah, I loved that. I didn't put that together, actually, around the World Skills Centre of Excellence. We've got a podcast on that. But it being a collective intelligence hub, because that's, you know, we're seeing that coming out of, Qatar Foundation, out of the G20, out of all their Think Tank 20 are all talking about collective intelligence being the future. I love that. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I'm so conscious we're over time, but I'm going to go wild. Do you know what I mean? I ain't finished my coffee yet. Let's go wild. can we talk about levelling up and particularly what can the sector do to come together to make impactful change? It's a bit of a sort of an extension of what we talked about there around the ecosystem for the whole sector.
Yeah.
But how can we make impactful change that actually makes difference to individuals, to families, communities, employers? You know, how can we really, we've got this unique opportunity where we've got, for us, we've had Boris Johnson write for us in the last 6 months, and Rishi, yeah, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, Education Secretary, the Employability Minister, is about to have some more from other people I'm sure probably shouldn't talk about. But it's just like there's that they're interested. Yeah, you know, how can we do more? How can we do more impactful change? How can we come together more?
Yeah, so I'll speak, I suppose, initially a little bit more negatively about that, and then I'll move to something that hopefully is a lot more positive. I think there's a real risk that levelling up becomes the new big society, where most of us didn't really understand what it meant. No, not many people really understood what happened. It certainly wasn't, you know, durable over the long term, and I'm sure there was, you know, really positive sentiment in there, but we just couldn't make sense of it. And I spoke fairly recently about this, actually, and Boris Johnson is interested, but when we're talking about, you know, chopping down the tallest poppies and zero sum games, the people on the street, you know, the likes of, well, certainly me, I'm thinking, I don't even know what you mean. Do you know, I've got an interpretation of it. So I think we've got to get really, really clear, really precise about our language and make sure that it's relatable to people in the sector and they want to take action towards it. So rather than having a million interpretations of what it is that we actually mean, let's get really clear on our definition. And then there might be lots of different paths to get there, and that's absolutely fine, but let's make it clear what it is that we're actually trying to achieve. And my interpretation of levelling up is, for me, it's about giving every single individual, no matter what their starting point, no matter what, you know, advantage, disadvantage they've had in the life, it's giving them the opportunities, the means, which is really important as well, because opportunity alone won't make it work. The means, and sometimes that's financial means, but also sort of the motivation and the inspiration to move towards, you know, really ambitious goals and objectives, or even quite humble goals and objectives. So opportunity means and motivation. And to do that, you know, the whole of the education system, I think, needs to be centered on a deep understanding of learners or prospective learners, a deep understanding of their context, and a deep understanding of opportunities, and understanding what works to be able to provide, well, what has worked and can work to provide, you know, fantastic educational experiences to give people the best possible outcomes and the best possible, not just educational outcomes and progression, but career outcomes and progression and life outcomes and progression. Education shouldn't just be about work. Work is hugely important, but how do we ensure that we take every opportunity through education and through learning to help people have the most meaningful and fulfilling lives? And that, for me, is if that's what levelling up is about. It's about giving learner's agency. So what I mean by that is that they understand their choices, they're informed to make good choices, that they have the resources around them to ensure that they have a fantastic educational experience. Do you know, even if they've got, you know, childcare responsibilities, caring responsibilities, they're having to work every hour, that can still really engage. And they understand that actually learning is a lifetime thing. Do you know, if you want to be included in not just the labour market, but in society more broadly, and you want to have a meaningful and fulfilling life, this is a thing that you're going to have to commit to over a lifetime. But this is what we do to help you to own that yourself. That for me, is that's what Levelling Up is about. And this is where we need to point collective intelligence and collective resources to deliver on that.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, that's really cool. Just a quick fire, a couple of bits now, because I know that I've gone over. But I could talk to you for ages. Well, a second coffee. If you could dream and dream big, what would be one thing you'd want to change around the whole sector and to seize a difference?
See, it's a brilliant question, but one thing. What would it be? Because there's so many things. Do you know what I think it would come down to, actually, off the top of my head? Creating the right time and space and environment, conditions, resources to enable educators to help every single learner to be the very best they can possibly be. That's it.
Yeah.
Do you know, because the person, do you know, so we can design perfect qualifications, we can design perfect content, we can design perfect buildings, we can have, do you know, the best tools and technology. If that educator is not able to engage, infuse, inspire, educate, instruct, do you know, arm around the shoulder, kick up the backside, if they don't have the conditions that enable them to do that, it almost doesn't matter. It's then just down to whether that individual learner happened to have, you know, the right start in life, you know, the right conditions at home, the right brain to succeed in how the world runs. Educators alone are the one thing that I believe, and I know to be true, they can make the biggest difference, but we have to give them the conditions to be able to do that. And of course, brilliant qualifications matter. And of course, you know, brilliant content and fantastic facilities and great careers advice, all of those things really matter. But if we don't get it right for educators to enable them, to resource them, to inspire them, to be inspiring, it falls down right there. So that's what
I'd be. 100%. I think it's having that time to be able to make impactful change to people, because everyone remembers that, or maybe they don't remember that teacher that maybe inspired them to make a difference. So they have, you know, they can sort of, when they're struggling or when they're doing well, to make them fly, isn't it, really?
But you know what? We can all be educators in some senses. You know, we're not going to be qualified teachers, and we might not all do it. But every line manager, do you know, every leader, do you know, every colleague, do you know, can play a part in your learning journey through life. Do you know, so if we think about as a society, everyone has got the potential to add value to the human experience of everyone they come into contact with. And just, you know, leave people better than you found them. Do you know, teach them something, share some knowledge, show them a skill. Do you know that? And you know, parents with children, carers with children, do you know, with dependents. That for me, that's the big dream. Do you know, that every single one of us, literally every single one of us, wants to play an active part in helping other people to be the best they can be. Our formal educators, I think, let's start there. And then, yeah, do you know, maybe in another 50 years, we'll take on the rest of the world.
We need to find a term for it, like, that makes sense, not like Levelling Up or
Yeah.
Because I don't know what that means. It sounds like making people go and do volunteering, really, didn't it? But the last question, yeah, NTFE, I said it right at the very beginning, I did the intro, you know. I see you guys as, I don't know if I've got the right term, but I see it as a social impact organisation. Do you know what I mean? It's around making impactful, positive change. You know, you're an awarding organisation, got loads of different organisations, part of the family, that are all coming together to support the sector as different elements of the ecosystem, you know, from mental health to think tank. I think it's great to be able to have an independent think tank. It's really important for the sector. And I think maybe lots of people don't realise what Campaign for Learning is all about. But also, the stuff you're doing with Well Skills, the collective intelligence hub that is just basically gifted to be able to help the whole sort of UK system, I think is fantastic. But what next for NCFE? You know, there's a lot in there. Do you know what I mean? So what next? You know, it talks about loads. What do you sort of see like the next big thing for you?
Well, there's lots in there. So how can I say this really quickly and simply? So do you know that I think we've established a really clear vision for what we want education and learning to be about over the long term. So what next for us, I suppose, is through our people and working with partners, how do we make sense of that? You know, how do we take this abstract picture of this idealized future world that, you know, we're going to die trying to get there because it will probably take longer than our careers and lifetimes to achieve it. How do we actually turn that into, you know, what I've described as the architect's drawing? Do you know, how do we turn it into something that is actionable? Because we can say, this little thing here, like this World Skills Center of Excellence, or this little thing here, that's what will take us towards that future. And I'm incredibly fortunate, you know, that NCFE, we've got brilliant people who are really, really committed to get into that vision, but and almost in a really humble way, knowing that, you know, we might not get there in 10 years, but that's where we're headed. And through, you know, partnerships like World Skills and AOC and other bodies that we're working with to get alignment around that, and then say, right, from an NCFE perspective, how in a small way can we put our resources into that, you know, to put fuel in the tank, to, you know, throw ideas in there, to align different organizations to delivering that vision. So there's loads of things that we're doing, but the simple version is at the center of our strategy is about prospective learners, helping them to make the best possible choice about learning. Then at the start of the learning journey, which will last a lifetime, setting people up for success, you know, so diagnostic assessments, content that helps, you know, set people up for success, providing brilliant qualifications and content and enabling our centres to deliver world-class educational experiences, and then measuring ourselves, not just on the outcomes of that, so, you know, has somebody passed or failed, but ultimately, what's the impact? Do you know, what's the impact? Is this person, you know, got a better job, better paid, happier, healthier? And we are going to hold ourselves to account for the impact that we deliver. And if we don't deliver the impact that is needed for those learners and for the system, we'll simply go and do other things that we're better placed to do. So that for me is what next for NCFE, the best decisions about learning, the best experiences, the best outcomes, and the best progression, and holding ourselves to account for the impact that we deliver with the resources that we've got, but knowing actually that we can only play a small part in that because we're not, you know, we're not the biggest organization. We are, you know, we're scaling the business, but we're not the biggest. And that's I suppose what we're up to. So there's some interesting real practical things, because that's a bit abstract, that are coming out over the next few months. So a bit of watch this space as well, Gavin.
Yeah, tree planting. That's what you're doing. You're planting trees for someone else to sit in that shade or enjoy the fruit, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
David, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you, everyone. I went over, but I'm sure that you'll appreciate this. I was enjoying myself. It was really good. And I've still got coffee left, which is unusual for me. But David, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you, everyone. And join us on the next virtual coffee, which is now always going to be in this live stream format. And I hope you enjoyed it. David, I hope you enjoyed it too. I enjoyed it. And thank you for sharing all those gems. Thank you so much.
No, not at all, Gavin. It was brilliant. Good to speak to you. Thank you.
So thanks, everyone.